Hello, and thank you for listening to A Fine Mess, a podcast dedicated to discussion of creative pursuits. I'm your host, Jeff Giles. Today's episode finds us speaking with Amir Talai, an actor whose name you may not know, but whose face you've more than likely seen in one of the many television shows, commercial spots, and movies he's appeared in over the last decade. I've known Amir since his days in the Bay Area theater scene, and have long admired him for not only his talent, but his methodical dedication to building a career in a field whose glamorous exterior masks its often crushing difficulty. With pilot season on his mind and a crowded slate of projects that includes the Rob Riggle and J.B. Smoove web series Coogan Auto, Amir's always busy, but he found a few moments to sit down and discuss his background, his approach to managing his craft, and his thoughts on making a living with art. This is A Fine Mess. The first thing I wanted to ask you about was when you knew this is what you wanted to do, because I think the stereotypical image of a young Persian boy, even one growing up in the Bay Area, would be that, you know, your parents might have been a little taken aback or were expecting something a little less risky.
Yeah, I mean, I think that describes my family pretty well. Risk averse. I think that all along I had a sense that this is what I wanted to do, but I also had, you know, a fallback and a fallback to the fallback, and you know, I never planned to major in acting or anything like that. You know, I thought I was going to get a real job. And so I went to a good college. I went to Cal, and I had a good major, communications, with a emphasis in marketing and advertising. And I thought, you know, I'll do the marketing and advertising thing, and I'll do acting on the side. And then if the acting thing works out, then I can hop over. But what happened was I realized that you can't do anything on the side of marketing and advertising. Entry-level jobs are like 60 hours a week. So as soon as I graduated, I ended up doing just sort of part-time work. And pretty quickly, I was making about half of my income off of acting. And so I thought, okay, this is possible. You know, if I can increase this ratio, then I'll be good. And eventually, I did.
But pursuing the arts is, you know, trying to support yourself with any kind of creative work, it's kind of like being on welfare, in that, you know, you reach a point where you have to make a leap. You can't reliably subsidize your income one way or the other. Like, you have to go full force. You have to go all in, and that requires a pretty scary leap.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I mean, I know a lot of people who, you know, depending on the job that they have, they can increase or decrease their side work hours as necessary. For me, it worked out because the .com job that I was working, I got laid off from. Mm. And then immediately after that, I booked two big jobs, so the leap was sort of made for me, right. And then of course I also had, because I got laid off and because I had a job that ended, I had unemployment to work off of. So I don't know, that leap wasn't as scary for me as the leap that entailed me driving to Los Angeles for the first time when I moved here. That was what was scary for me.
Right. If you hadn't been laid off, how long do you think you would have kept a foot in both worlds?
I imagine as long as possible.
Okay.
I think that like I said, you know, I grew up in a risk-averse household.
Yeah.
And even, you know, even now, even though I'm making all of my money on acting, you know, I will, you know, I'll look around for my house for a book that I can sell on Amazon. you know, or I'll do some sort of ride share when I drive to San Francisco just to pay for my gas money. Like, it's just it's a constant. I mean, I think it's ingrained in me, not just because of my upbringing, but because of my job, you know, that I always got to make sure I've got something coming in.
Yeah, it's a scary field. I mean, as a writer, I know a lot of writers who are either really struggling or who lose their gigs, and it's been going on for a long time now, and every time I see somebody else fall, I do the same type of mental inventory that you're talking about. Like, how many assets do I have that I can sell? How much of the, what is not nailed down around here?
Yeah.
That I can use to buy food if I have to.
Can I rent out my office on Airbnb?
What was the conversation like with your folks when you decided to make that drive?
You know, I had done a play or a musical in San Francisco, and I was pretty much the only main actor that wasn't from LA and New York, and and everyone in the cast was like, you gotta get out of San Francisco. You're ready. And I was like, I don't know, you know. And they're like, no, trust me, you would work. And then I thought, all right, well, maybe it's time to give it a try. So I told my folks, hey, I'm going to quit acting for about a year, work 40 hours a week, not do any acting, and save up a good little chunk of money. And then I'm going to move down to LA. And my folks were like, well, how much of a chunk are you thinking? And I'm like, hey, you know, $5,000-$10,000. And they said, all right, we'll give you $5,000 if you move down right now.
Wow.
That and unemployment should keep you afloat for a while. And it did. It was sort of great. And sort of by the end of that first year, I started booking work in LA. But yeah, that first year was really lean, and I had to live off of, you know, my savings and that gift and unemployment. So, but they were pretty cool about it. I mean, I think they got the sense that things were starting to happen for me in San Francisco, and it seemed like a reasonable risk moving down to LA. And, you know, at the same time, I still had my college degree, and if it didn't work out, I would come back, you know?
Right. So obviously you were coming from a good position. There was a nice combination of events that sort of conspired together to kind of push you in that direction. But one of the things that I have always really admired about your approach to your career is that you were really methodical about finding work, about advancing yourself as an actor. I mean, I think with a lot of creative fields, that's the kind of thing that people tend to forget you need to do, or they're not really temperamentally set up for it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that comes from, you know, my dad, who's a workaholic, and my education that, you know, I've always been sort of a nose to the grindstone worker, or at least thinker. You know what I mean? I was never someone that like studied for tests until 2 a.m, but I always, you know, was up on everything and always paying attention and always sort of trying to, I don't know, figure out what was needed of me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess, you know, in the Bay Area, you sort of have to be that way because the work is sort of few and far between, that you have to constantly look for opportunities. I was trying to see if I could get a voiceover job, an industrial job, a print job, a little theater job that paid, you know, a couple hundred for a weekend or something like that. And I sort of, when I moved to LA, I brought that same work ethic with me. And then I was introduced to this really great organization called the Actors Network that really helped me figure out how to put all that energy to use in LA. Because I think a lot of actors would, you know, try harder if they sort of knew what to do. You know, mm-hmm. you're always told to be proactive, but a lot of people don't know what that means and don't have the sense to find out. But what's great about the Actors Network is it really helped me figure out, you know, some great avenues to keep pursuing work and to keep my nose to the grindstone.
So when it comes to acting in particular, I mean, I think with all creative fields, you're talking about an emotional craft where you're kind of offering a big chunk of who you are for public approval or rejection. And that's a tough thing to get around. But with acting in particular, do you think, given those tools, any actor would be able to take that approach to kind of divorce their who they are themselves from the kind of the product that they're presenting?
Are you talking about like pursuing your career as a business person separate from the artist and knowing that they
partly that and partly really getting around dealing with rejection?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I don't think many people are cut out for the amount of rejection that you get in this business. I think that you have to have almost a religious faith that it's going to work out. And once that faith is broken, then you're done. You're cooked.
Right.
But for me, it's, you know, it's just a sense that, like, if this job it doesn't happen, the next one will. And I'm sort of unshakable in that. And I know, and, you know, maybe I won't get the next 10 jobs. But I feel like someday I'm going to get another one. And you know, thank goodness I've got enough of sort of a savings so that if I don't book for a little while, I'll be okay and it won't be time to panic. But yeah, it's about faith. And if you don't have that, then you need to quit.
I remember, you know, you've kind of reached a little bit of a almost a critical mass now where you're on the verge of being like that guy.
That would be nice.
But I remember back when you were doing stuff like Nash Bridges where we would hear, hey, Amir's got this role that he's booking and he's going to be on television on this day. And then you'd go and you watch. And then it would be a little while before you heard anything else again. And that how did you get... I mean, it's one thing to say it's about religious faith, but what steps would you take in between those gigs in order to keep yourself going?
You know, I guess it's like having a short memory, like a quarterback that throws an interception, yeah, or a cornerback that gives up a touchdown. You know, it happens, and then you move on. You don't sort of dwell on the sort of glory of, oh, I worked with these great people last week, and you know, it's just the same way when something good happens. You need to move on and get the next thing. Mm-hmm. When something bad happens and you don't get a part, you need to move on and get the next thing. It's just about sort of having tunnel vision and never looking in your rearview mirror and just sort of keep on going. I know that those are sort of truisms, but I just sort of feel like, or whatever, I feel like it if you just keep that viewpoint, you keep moving.
They are truisms, but it's also, those are wise words for anybody who's trying to be creative, because I think a lot of the achievements that people see as kind of making it in creative fields are really nominal, transitory goals. I mean, you book a part, you pick up a byline, you make an album, and, you know, that's what everybody looks at as kind of the brass ring, but it's really just a step.
Yeah, I mean, even if you look at... if you look at What to Expect When You're Expecting, which was a huge deal for me, like, yeah, the biggest movie I've ever been in, you know, sizable role, working with amazing actors, that was really, really great. But to be perfectly honest, that was 8 months ago. And I finished the film, you know, a year and a half ago. And that is, I could sort of enjoy that for a little while. And you know, when I was auditioning around that time, people were certainly cognizant of it. But it doesn't really come up anymore. You know what I mean? It doesn't come up in rooms very often when I audition for stuff. You know, at this point, what comes into the room with me is the relationship that I've got with that casting director, that producer, and the sort of talent that I have in the room. They're not that impressed that I worked with Chris Rock a year and a half ago. As amazing as that was, you know what I mean? Like I said, I'll always have that sort of feather in my cap. But there's no point in there's it, you know, these medals don't serve you.
Right. These medals don't serve you. That's a good way to put it. when it comes to something like What to Expect, when you're in something that is being widely consumed,
not that widely.
Well, okay, that's what I'm getting at. What's your relationship with the critical reaction to a movie like that?
I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm pretty divorced from it usually. Uh-huh. I want it to be acclaimed. I want people to like it, but I haven't yet gotten to the point where I can take responsibility for any piece of work that I'm a part of.
Right.
Because thus far I've been a pretty small part of anything that I've been in, you know.
Right.
What to Expect was, it just had so many moving parts that I was sort of happy to be a part of it, you know. But that film really belonged to the director and the studio, and I, you know, I was happy that most people liked it. But at the same time, I didn't really take responsibility for that. My scenes, you know, if they had gotten a little more specific, the reviews, and said like, oh, the scenes with the guys really worked or were really clunky. Mm-hmm. That's something that I think I might have taken more notice of. But in the abstract, I'm hoping people enjoy it. I'm hoping it does well so that it can move my career forward. But I'm not consumed with its reception.
Okay. I interviewed an actress back in the spring, the weekend that she had what I think was her first theatrical release coming out. And at the time, it was at 0% on the tomato meter.
Oh, my God. Awesome.
Yeah. And I said, I was being serious. I said something like, congratulations on the new film or something. And she just let out this sort of bitter little chuckle. And it occurred to me that it adds another layer to the... I guess kind of the relationship that you need to consider. Like, first you have to get past the casting director, and then you have to get past the director, and you have to get along with your cast, and you have that whole experience. And then when something comes out for mass consumption like that, and there's a whole other thing that you've got to worry about. But like you say, you know, on a movie set, you're one small moving part out of many.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I get, you know, Robert De Niro has made terrible, terrible movies also.
Oh, yeah.
I guess, you know, if I played a lead role, or if I wrote a movie or directed a movie, then I would feel a lot of pressure to have it come out fantastic. But for me, I'm more of a craftsperson, you know. I go to work, I have fun, I try to bring as much as I can every day on set, and then after that I'm sort of done. I hope it does well, and I want it to do well for not just for me but for everybody involved with it. But I can't say that I'm sort of invested in it emotionally. I always say that I try to be invested professionally but not emotionally.
Clearly you are in a line of work where appearance is very important.
Oh my God.
And a person who appears the way you appear faces...
I want to know where you're going here.
Faces a certain set of roles, shall we say, often.
Okay.
And I know that like speaking from my personal experiences, when I was recording music, you know, who you want to be as an artist when you're starting out is often very different from who you get to be because of whatever physical gifts or limitations you've been given. So, you know, I could start out wanting to be a heavy metal singer, and after about 2 weeks, I'd have to realize that I needed to tailor my my music to in a different direction. And this is a roundabout way of asking how you shape your craft based on the reality of the acting industry that you have to deal with. You know, like, does it change the type of stuff that you work on? Does it change the type of stuff you write? And does it change the way you present yourself to casting directors when you go out for roles?
I mean, I guess there's two main sort of drives that I have as an actor. One is to do work that I find fulfilling, and the other is to make money and pay my mortgage. And I have to put the making money first.
Mm-hmm.
I have to keep my head above water. And so, how do I present myself? In whatever way is going to help me book this audition today.
Right.
Then on the side of that, I know that I'm going to die inside if I, you know, only do things to make money. So if I'm not being fulfilled in my Domino's auditions every day, then I find those things that are fulfilling, even if they don't pay money, as on the side, right? So yeah. Whether it is a short film or writing a short film or doing a play or something like that, that's something that you can sort of work on, but I've never had a big sort of, but I want people to see me like this. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? I don't. It's never really occurred to me. I just want to keep working, and I know that when you keep working, you'll get more and varied opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you start working at the very beginning of your career, there is a very small sliver of the industry that you are allowed to be in, you know, by the size of the role, the type of the role. But as you continue to work, that expands, you know, and I'm trying out for and playing, you know, roles that I never could have done 10 years ago, you know, plus you age, things change. So I think it'd be different if I was someone who was easily pigeonholed, but that's never really happened to me, so it hasn't really been a big concern for me.
Why do you feel like you're not easily pigeonholed?
I'm not sure. Maybe it's because I cast a wide net for myself. Maybe there's something versatile about me. In my abilities or in my look that allows people to see me in other ways. You know, I do know that I'm a complex person in the sense that I'm an all-American guy from an immigrant family who, you know, grew up relatively affluent, but in a very mixed city, San Francisco. I was exposed to, you know, a lot of different viewpoints. You know, we probably had money to be Republicans, but we were Democrats. You know what I mean?
Right.
Not to mention the fact that I'm an actor, and so I've been poor. Thank God I had my parents to sort of fall back on if I ever got really poor, but I haven't had money, and now I sort of do have money again. Not to mention the fact that I'm a huge goofball, but I'm also, you know, really sort of sensitive and brainy. So I guess I sort of have enough going on that people can fit me into different categories. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know that people get pigeonholed very much if they don't deserve it, if that's a legitimate thing to say. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, well, you know, for what's that guy? Tiny Lister? Liston? The huge guy that played Zeus in the WWF and who was in the Friday movies. You know, he's not complaining that he doesn't get to play romantic leads. You know what I mean? Because he knows. He's like, this is what I do. I can't do more than this. And he does it, and he does it great, and he cashes that check, and he, you know, pays his mortgage and plays with his kids.
I think you probably have a broader palate than that guy.
Yes, I would hope so.
But I mean, you can do drama, you can do comedy. But a lot of people who are capable of doing both of those things don't always get opportunities to do both of those things.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think another huge reason that I've gotten those opportunities is that I've got a team who believes in my ability to do those things and has the juice to get me into different rooms. I think that's another a big thing about getting pigeonholed is, you know, if you don't have a strong team, which I really sort of lucked into, you're going to be stuck because they're going to be fighting to get you in on anything, and they're going to sort of go for that low-hanging fruit of the most obvious sort of pigeon-holy type roles.
Yeah, right,
you know?
Right. You said What to Expect was the biggest.
Yeah.
It seems like in terms of steady residuals, Kung Fu Panda would be the one that would...
It's funny you say steady, because I had to...
What?
Yeah. I
think I saw you making a reference to something.
Yeah, I... Look.
All right.
Kung Fu Panda has been fantastic, but they took over a year to pay me my first residual check.
That's crazy.
Is a testament to downsizing in the payment department of Viacom, which I just think is spectacular because Viacom just had record earnings a couple quarters ago.
Right, right.
So it's easy to, you know, sit on my money for a while. So when you say steady residual, I wish it were a little steadier. But the floodgates have finally opened, so hopefully things will continue to come in. It's hard to say, actually. That's why I don't know, because it hasn't been that steady. I just got a huge lump sum for the last like year and a half, which is great. I just do wish it had been a little steadier. I hate to talk ill of my employer. I love everybody at Nickelodeon. No kidding. Everybody's really cool there. But the payment department could have stepped it up.
Yeah, I remember when I picked up publishing on that Rascal Flatts song. It took Sony,
God,
about that long to pay me, I think, and I had to go find somebody.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah,
there's no downside for them. There's no downside for corporations to sit on your money forever. Because what are you going to do? Just bitch and bitch and bitch? They don't care.
I have spent the last year talking to a lot of soap actors, and voiceover work is an area that a lot of them are trying to get into.
Mm-hmm.
You've been fortunate enough to pick up a lot of those gigs. It seems like it's...
To be perfectly honest, it's not a lot.
It looks like a lot on your IMDb page.
Well... I think I've done the Seth MacFarlane cartoons like five or six times, and mostly American Dad. There's a guy named Matt Weitzman at American Dad who's a fan of mine, so he brings me in every now and then. That's awesome. And then I lucked into this Kung Fu Panda gig 4 years ago. Other than that, over the last 3 years, I haven't booked any voiceover work. And it's I just switched agents. We'll see if that changes anything. But it's a really tough space to get into. It's incredibly saturated. It's small. There's no risk of overexposure for the extremely talented and popular people.
Right.
So it's a very it's sort of a rich get richer type of situation where the really great people are working constantly and everyone else is sort of scraping the bottom of the bowl barrel. What the hell am I trying to say? But
microphone?
Yeah, I mean, I love that I have Kung Fu Panda, and I hope that leads to more. You know, thus far it hasn't. But we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens this year.
So, when you can do all this stuff, you have voice work on your resume. You can do dramatic work. You can do comedy. How do you go about honing your craft? How do you know what to focus on? Do you take a methodical approach to that too?
You know, I've been in a class for like 10 years. I go every week, you know, with several month breaks here and there, for work or whatever. But I'm in a class, and the emphasis of the class is working on those areas of your range that you don't have the easiest access to.
Okay.
And I feel that, so I'm constantly trying to expand my range. The things that I already do well, I work on enough that is training enough. So I'm no longer really working on my comedy chops, because I audition for comedy so much and I work in comedy so much that's good. That's good enough. But I'm continually trying to expand what I'm capable of dramatically, since that's not as strong for me as comedy.
Why do you think it's not as strong?
I don't know. I think I just, you know, I'm sort of a natural goofball, and I have a high sort of tempo, a sort of an internal tempo. I'm quick, you know. I'm sharp, and I think that I didn't grow up being emotionally expressive, you know. I was more about being sort of mentally expressive, if that makes sense, you know.
Sure.
Using my brain, using my words, using my humor, and that's a muscle that I've been sort of exercising since I was five. And really sort of the emotional end of it is something I you know, haven't really sort of tapped into as much until, you know, I sort of got out of college.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I guess that's just sort of a personal that's just sort of a personality trait of mine, you know, separate from my acting, but obviously very influential on my acting.
So, since we're talking about honing your craft, and we're talking about work, and we're talking about a type of work that, to a lot of people, does not look like work.
Yeah.
How do you divide up your life? How do you strike a balance between being Amir and, all caps, Amir?
You know, like I said, I really see myself as a craftsperson.
Uh-huh.
You know, I had a teacher a long time ago say, you know, approach your acting career the way a plumber approaches their career, and I've always really kept that to heart. His name was Greg Lee, by the way, great guy. I've always really kept that to heart. You know, when I go in for an audition, I'm usually not nervous just the same way a plumber isn't nervous. You know, the plumber comes in, he gives you the estimate.
Might be nervous for different reasons.
But he comes in, he gives you the estimate, and if you're into it, you know, you hire him. Right. I take that same approach when I audition, and I guess I have that same feeling when I'm sort of out and about. You know, like I don't walk around thinking of myself as an artist or as an actor or as a guy who's been on a billboard. You know, as exciting as all that stuff is, absolutely. Same thing, you know, a plumber doesn't walk around and say, like, I'm a plumber, this is what I do, this is who I am. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So
I think often though it's easier for a plumber to clock out, you know, and the division between life and work and craft is a little more, or it can be a little more amorphous for somebody who's in
that's
a
true
field.
Yeah, I mean, I know that certainly when I first started in LA, I would wake up and all I had on my mind was, how do I get my next job?
Right.
And when you're starting, that there's nothing more important than that. And honestly, when I started, there wasn't a separation. I was nothing but an actor, and that was by choice. You know, I completely threw myself into my career. I was pursuing every avenue I could, so I wanted to get things rolling. Now that I'm in my 30s and I'm married and I've had some success, I can relax a little bit and enjoy life a little more. But I still, you know, I still wake up every morning and sort of take stock of what's going to be needed of me that day. You know, whether it's work or class or writing, you know, I'm starting to try and create stuff for myself. I don't know, you know, I guess your question goes to how do I separate that when I'm by myself. And I'm not sure. I guess it's something that sort of happens naturally. And thank God I have a fairly healthy life that affords me that opportunity, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to a lot of creative people who talk about the guilt. There's kind of an ever-present guilt. Like, if you're not working on your craft, then you feel bad about that. And then if you're not with your family, then you feel bad about that too. You know, if you're not maintaining your personal relationships.
Sure.
I think it's tough to find a balance there.
Yeah, I think I felt more of that guilt about not attending to my career early on. But I will say, even to this day, I have a problem going to see a movie because I feel like, oh, that's sort of a big waste of time, right? That's like 3 hours just for me, and I should be doing something more productive, which usually ends up being, you know, Facebook and vegging out in front of the TV. But I do, you know what? I do still feel that guilt. I can't say that I feel the same guilt over neglecting my family and friends because thankfully I've made that more of a priority. And the reason I've been able to do that is my success. So, you know, I guess I have those early years of really putting my nose to the grindstone to thank for that, you know?
Sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, I mean, it worked out, you know. Both the hard work and just the dumb luck of this industry.
Well, you know, I think everybody who does anything like this needs both of those things.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And not just luck in the sense of, you know, right place, right time, right role, right time. But, you know, I'm stupid things. Like, I'm lucky that I have big eyes that read really quickly in commercials. You know, I'm lucky that my skin is a little tan, but not too tan. You know what I mean? Just right. Stupid things like that, that, you know, so much of this job is about your appearance. And, you know, my appearance is just dumb luck. You know, I came out this way.
Is there anything that you want to plug right now? I know you're going out for different roles.
No, I think really my focus right now is on pilot season. You're probably going to see me in a bunch of Old Navy commercials if you haven't already.
Did you steal Matt Walton's job?
I don't know who Matt Walton is.
Isn't he that? I think that's the name of that guy. The guy who was the he was little. He was like a little miniature singing guy in the Old Navy commercials for a minute. A year or two ago.
I can't say that I play a little miniature singing guy. So no.
Are you still doing Coogan Auto?
Oh God, yeah, let's plug Coogan Auto.
All right.
I shot Coogan Auto a few months ago, and it's on the web right now. It's on YouTube. We're hoping it turns into something more, but who knows? It was something created by Rob Riggle. Of you know, Daily Show and SNL and a bunch of other movies and stuff, and he and his good buddy JB Smoove are the main two guys, these assholes that work at a car dealership, and I play another asshole, and it's fun and dirty, it's really it's about nothing more than assholes who work at a car dealership, very much in that sort of Rob Riggle, Danny McBride sort of
right.
vein of like, of comedy. And it was so fun to work on. And it's, you know, people are watching it. People are enjoying it. We'll see if we do more of those, if maybe some network gets interested in doing a half-hour version. Yeah.
It's crazy to me that 10 years ago, working like that would not have been possible.
You know, we shot it so cheap, and you know, obviously, great guys. You know, guys who've been around comedy for a while
with talented
JB
cast.
And Rob and Horatio. And it was really just sort of like, let's have fun for a week, let's goof off, and hopefully something will come of it. So we'll see.
I know you're real active in the union, and I imagine that on some level, at some point, you must have been a little ambivalent about this kind of stuff opening up, but it creates so many possibilities.
I can't say that I'm ambivalent. You know, I think that I am involved in the union. I'm a big supporter of unions in general, and particularly my union, yeah. SAG-AFTRA. But I think that the more type of work there is, the better. All I want is for actors to be paid what they're worth, no matter. I shouldn't say what they're worth, but what they deserve.
It's a nice distinction.
Well, yeah, because you know, I think you're worth a different amount based on the project that you're working on.
Sure.
You know what I mean? You could be hilarious for one day of work in What to Expect, and you could be hilarious for one day of work in Coogan Auto. Ultimately, you are generating more income for one of those for the boss man. So you deserve a bigger paycheck.
Right.
You know. So I think you deserve, well, like I said, you deserve more. So I always like to see actors get what they deserve based on the project. No matter what the project is, you know, if I'm doing, you know, a fun little radio play, with some people at a theater, you know, the theater's not making much money, but I'm doing it for fun. And you know, if I make any money at all, I'm happy. but if it's strictly volunteer, that's cool too, you know. I just did a short for a buddy of mine. You know, I know he has no money, and so I did it for free. you know, but I'm not going to do anything for free for Harvey Weinstein. You know, it's I think it's logic.
I guess I made the ambivalence comment just because it's easy to look at stuff like this and think of it as taking an already fractured audience and fracturing it even further, you know, opening up so many different avenues for content that it's exceedingly difficult to monetize any of them.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess I sort of feel like the cream will rise, you know.
I hope so.
You know, not that I want acting, the acting world to follow the direction that music has gone, in the sense that there are a few insanely rich and popular music acts and almost everyone else is relegated to performing in little clubs for mm-hmm. no money. But I don't think that opening up a new club is bad for the music industry.
Right.
You know what I mean? I think that, you know, what has happened in between is more of the issue. And I obviously, I don't know anything about the music industry, but
nobody does.
Maybe that's the problem.
What I would like to see, I think that stuff like cable and the internet has thrown the networks into a little bit of a tailspin, where they don't have the type of you know, audience and hence advertising revenue to fall back on like they used to, and so they've kind of abrogated their responsibility to entertain in pursuit of cheaper and cheaper forms of entertainment. And so what I would like is for stuff like YouTube and Funny or Die, you know, to give rise to the type of situation where, as you say, the cream rises to the top and people are willing to pay for stuff they want to see.
Yeah. I think that'll all get figured out.
I hope so.
As long as people are, you know, forced to be above board in their conversations and negotiations.
Give me my $4,000.
Right?
That's all for this episode, but we'll be back in a few weeks with our next guest, Fred Wilhelm, who will share his journey from his youth on his family's Connecticut farm to his early years as a performer and recording artist in New York during the 80s, and how all of it led to his current status as a professional songwriter in Nashville. Until then, this has been A Fine Mess.